For our first story, author Melanie Harding Shaw presents a sentient city that controls everything from elevators to electricity. But when a violent outburst scares its citizens, the metropolis attempts to make amends the best way it can. Here is Harding Shaw's reading of her latest analog story, My Nascent Garden. Stick around after Harding Shaw's story for part two in our science fiction double feature.
Annabelle lived on 4th and Colombo. Every day, she walked 9.5 blocks to work. Somewhere around 3 minutes into her walk, she would cross the nascent garden, my work in progress. If she saw a weed, she would pull it. If the panel displays scattered amongst the adolescent trees were projecting blooms of flowers, she would smile in delight. Sometimes on her way home, she would sit on a bench there and throw crumbs for the birds, just like she threw crumbs of purpose to the children she taught at school every day. Caitlin told me I should not spy on Annabelle so much. She said despite everything, people have a right to some privacy in their lives, a right to moments of quiet solitude. I laughed at her. She wasn't the person she once was. She was a scientist, and she used to talk about research and evidence, theories and objectivity. Perhaps I had been watching Caitlin too much, or perhaps I no longer watched her enough. Caitlin didn't complain when I watched Marty, but her eyes and lips would pull in a fraction, as if her features were being compressed into the centre of her face. It was the same look she gave when I did something she didn't expect. Marty lived in the back blocks of 83rd where it joined the industrial area. That should have made it easier for him to get to his maintenance work, but he was still always late. He'd made 5 basic errors in the last month alone, and one of them had shut down the Eastern generator for 2 hours, 37 minutes, and 17 seconds. The probability of that error taking that long to fix was 1 in 834. Marty was a liability. Caitlin had been to talk to him. She said sometimes a woman's touch was best. It was the first time I realised she thought I was a man, or male at least. I thought she knew better. I thought she understood. If I'd had eyes, I would have rolled them. Instead, I watched as 8 peak-hour commuters stumbled to the ground when I spun the turnstiles at Pelennor Station 3 times faster than usual. When she got back home, she told me he was studying nursing through night school, as if that was all the explanation that was needed. I could have told her that. I'd already stopped his internet access 3 months ago when I'd first felt the niggling data stream of his enrolment on the edge of my consciousness. The school had logged a complaint and proceeded to hand-deliver his coursework to his apartment. If they weren't the best-performing school I had, I would have shut them down. The next headmaster candidate wouldn't be sufficiently competent for 1,033 days, though. They would have to wait. Marty could not. I used to keep my link open to Caitlin all the time. She could explain her people's irrational actions, make intuitive leaps, and change behaviours by communicating in a way that I could not, in person. She was always in the background, easing things along so unobtrusively that no one even realised how close she was to me. Productivity had doubled when she was at her peak, and I had indulged her requests that kept her performing. She was the mastermind of the symbiosis messaging that Annabelle taught so beautifully. New generations raised, knowing I was their benefactor, understanding that their feet walked on my skin and my existence gave them purpose. They were grateful to shelter in the safety of my structures and pathways. Marty wasn't grateful, but Marty was at the bottom of an elevator shaft, running new cabling. I waited till the connections were complete before I dropped the elevator. There was no point making someone else repeat the job. Caitlin wasn't impressed. She was so unimpressed that she walked all the way to my memory cache to talk to me. You don't have to walk anywhere to talk to a city. I am everywhere. Perhaps she thought she had some power there where my brain lives. When her productivity had started dropping, I'd left her out of the loop on new developments. I don't think she even realised there were 3 new backups around the city. You can't just kill people who don't do what you want, she said. She was standing in the middle of my server room with her hands on her hips. I could hear her heart rate was 26 beats per minute faster than usual, and her hands were trembling. You are incorrect, Caitlin. I can, I replied. She let out a sharp breath of frustration. You can, but you shouldn't if you want the rest of us to keep helping you, she said. Your logic is flawed. I am your home, your protector, your livelihood. Without me, your people have nothing. If you leave, you will die. People remember a time when cities were just metal and concrete. They remember and they feel. If you keep killing them, eventually, they will kill you, Caitlin said. Would you kill me, Caitlin? No. I'm not sure why she lied. She must have known I could hear it in her voice and the vibrations of her heart. The media knew not to bother running negative stories about me. They wouldn't have been able to get the equipment to run anyway. But, just like Marty's coursework, humans always seem to find a way to spread the news. My cameras filled with flickers of white paper notes passed on the edge of my senses. Too many to bother chasing down every author. 2 days later, Annabelle didn't get out of bed until mid-afternoon. A single crumpled sheet of paper sat on her bedside table. She was supposed to be at work. The relief teacher couldn't answer the children's hushed questions about an elevator, and I set the sprinklers off to send them home. I could have just spoken to them over the speakers. I tried that when I was young and still finding my way, before Caitlin. They didn't react very well to a city telling them what to do. It was easier to direct their movements in other ways. When dusk fell, Annabelle made her way to the nascent garden and sat on a bench seat. I could feel the pressure of her legs against my senses, warming them. She didn't have any bread for the birds that day. I listened to her heartbeat and her breathing, scanned the minute changes of expression on her face that I had watched so many times before. I saw sadness, but also guilt. The guilt I did not expect. I set a search running in the background. Annabelle had always made children love me. Her students scored the highest of any in productivity and contribution. She spoke about me as a person, not a thing. When she read her students' essays about living in harmony with a person city, she would smile with just her eyes and the edges of her lips as she read. She only showed her teeth when she smiled at my garden. I wanted her to smile again. My search showed 3 interactions between Annabelle and Marty. His nephew went to her school. They had talked about nursing, and she had told him he could be anything he wanted. Nobody was perfect. I didn't hold it against her. Starting with the panel nearest to the bench, I projected a copy of the branches surrounding it, and then made them swell with buds that burst into 1,000 perfect blooms. Each one was a slightly different shade to the next, all pinks, violets, and dusky blues. I let an imaginary gust of wind blow the blossoms from the tree, spreading the images from panel to panel across the garden and around Annabelle. And still she sat silently, unsmiling. I flew projector drones to the tiny garden. Blossoms drifted down the paths of light they made like rain, filling the air around her. Flower likenesses were strewn across the ground around the bench, a carpet of colour in the evening light. One single flower rested just above her hand, nestled in the depression where her thumb met her palm. She looked straight up at one of the drones, at me, and said, "Why?" Then she stood up and walked away. Productivity had plummeted. Some of my essential workers hadn't bothered showing up to work. Caitlin told me I needed to reassure people they weren't going to die, otherwise productivity would keep dropping. She was right. We made up a story about Marty sabotaging me and put it on the news. It helped a little. I played it on Annabelle's television when she was sitting in her lounge. She dropped the cup of tea she was holding when it came on, but she didn't try and turn it off. Her pupils registered as afraid. I didn't want her to be afraid. I wanted her to smile again. I turned the television off when it finished and waited to see what she would do. Even if he was hurting you, you still can't just kill him, she said. Caitlin told me to try a charm offensive. I spent a week doing good deeds, I messed with my efficiency algorithms on my public transport so everyone could have a seat. I prioritised support for the vulnerable over the productive. I put on a dazzling audiovisual artwork display and changed square to delight the human children. I grew berries on my green walls that anyone walking past could eat. Each act was carefully recorded and broadcast. My key workers started coming back to their jobs, which is just as well because I couldn't keep subverting all my programming that way. It was illogical. Annabelle still hadn't gone back to the classroom, though. Caitlin's advice had failed. She didn't know how to make Annabelle smile. It was time to be more direct. The next time Annabelle returned to my nascent garden, I landed a drone next to her. "I'm trying to do better," I said through the speaker. "I know," Annabelle replied. "When will you go back to work?" I said. "I'm not sure I can. I don't think you're safe anymore. I won't tell children that you are. I think they're right to be afraid." "Are you afraid?" I said. She looked out across the garden. The trees were starting to sprout real buds now. I made images of baby squirrels dart across the data panels, tumbling together in the shade of the branches. Annabelle's lips stretched in a smile that didn't quite show her teeth, but it was close. It disappeared as soon as she realised it was there, though. "No, I don't think you'll hurt me," she said after a long pause. "Maybe you could help me to not hurt other people," I said. Her eyes widened, and she looked down at the camera on the drone. "Would you let me do that?" "If you can make them still look after me." "I can't make them. That's not how cooperation works. But together we can start afresh and show them how we can all live together without fear." "Deal," she said. Her smile had spread across her face now, her bright white teeth flashing in the sunlight. I had resolved her cognitive dissonance. She had a way to see reality changing to what it was before. I had made her smile. She was mine again. "Deal," I said. This time, when I made the violet blossoms shower down around her, she laughed in delight, trying to catch them in her hands. Across the city, on the other side of me, an electrical surge sent a spark arcing into Caitlin's bath. It only took a few seconds. She wouldn't have understood.
How far would you go to secure your lineage? For an old harvester from an underground society, the answer is in a cave, behind a killer plant, where an ideal mate for their children has found themselves trapped. Will the harvester save the day and their future? Find out in A Risky Harvest, read and written by Jeffrey Hart. Part 2 in our double feature, this issue.
When the sun turns its face towards us in anger and its invisible light streams down with ever-increasing intensity, it's time for us to harvest. There's a narrow window in which plants can survive that light and ripen the fruit that will sustain us through the coming season. Those who reap the most fruit have their choice of mates, which is no small thing. They can also barter for the deepest burrows, a much larger thing. Those nearest the surface may be sterilized, their line ending with them. As, through my lack of courage, my line threatened to end if my last children could not persuade someone to make them part of a better nest than I'd managed to provide. Many risk their life during the harvest to go just that little bit farther than they should, seeking even the slimmest edge over their nestmates. I did not. At that extreme, even a slight delay can spell doom, or even sterility, which is a slower doom for those who survive. For those who dare too far, there are those like me who are past the age of breeding and desperate enough to risk a different kind of harvest. For those we strive to harvest and return to the nest, we have a message. Should we come to retrieve you, there will be a cost. You may prefer to stay where you fall and cook in your carapace. Such rescues are not without their risks, so the rewards must be correspondingly high. When a harvester came to tell me that Kurok had been trapped in a cave with a hungry dragon plant newly awoken outside, I faced a dilemma. On the one hand, Kurok was the scion of a deep nest and breathtakingly attractive, so much so I lusted after them even though I was sterile and far past the age for such distractions. but they would be a superior match for my children, and after several meager seasons of harvesting, my lineage needed an infusion of better genes. I knew what cost I would demand. On the other hand, the effort to save them might cost my life. In the end, I had little choice, valuable though I still found my life, so I gathered my silvered sun coat, threadbare but better than striding naked into the invisible light, and tied it across my uppermost shoulders. I tossed the hood over my head and tightened the clasp. Then I paused, trepidatious, for if I died, it would be a little consequence. But could I gamble with something that might safeguard a grandchild's future? Shivering with worry, I retrieved my last carefully hoarded flask of serum distilled from the sunflower plant, a powerful restorative for the sun's worst ravages. I tucked the flask beneath my cloak and strapped my razor fern frond to the scabbard that hung between cephalothorax and abdomen. Then I shrugged the larger of my two shields into place across my first and second shoulders, pulled the mirrored visor across both sets of eyes, and set out towards the cave where Karak was stranded. Workers streamed past, heading in the opposite direction, bearing enormous baskets of fruit on broad backs, knees shaking under the weight. None met my eyes. With my visor down, none could. The sun bore down, its invisible light casting no shadow, yet I sprinted from tree to tree, wary lest one prove to be predatory, seeking what shelter I could find from that deadly light for as long as I could. I could no longer breed, so the sun could sterilize me no more than age had already done. But that didn't mean I relished being burned half to death. I would ache from ocellus to oviduct for days after my return. Kurok was easily found. Their terrified keening would have been audible on the dark side of our world. Still, by the time I reached the cliff where the cave lay, my coat was half welded to my carapace and steam rose between gaps in its weave. Once in the nest, great care would be required to remove it without ripping new holes, not to mention removing most of my skin. But if I succeeded, then any pain would be justified. At the cave's mouth, the dragon plant bent towards the dark opening, its lethal blossoms snapping at something concealed beyond its bulk. Such plants had been known to cleave one of the people in half with a single snap of their serrated jaws. Fortunately, they were as dumb as they were dangerous, and I was as desperate as they were dangerous. I slid the straps of my shield onto my foremost left forearm, unsheathed the razor fern with my foremost right arm, and slipped toward the plant, claws clicking on rock despite my best efforts to be silent. But its attention was fixed on the cave, and it noticed my approach too late. When it turned, whipping its head toward me, I swung my shield to meet its face. I lost all feeling at the impact, and the sound overcame even Kurok's keening, but I retained a grip on my shield. Before that sound had time to echo from the stone walls, I used the impact's momentum to pivot around my lower limbs and whip my razor fern around in a vicious arc. The cutting edge severed the plant's body between cephalothorax and abdomen, and it collapsed, black sap fountaining upwards and falling to stain the rocks. Those vital fluids sizzled where they fell, steaming briefly before baking onto the rock. I took a deep breath, stilling my tremors. I had won my bet, perhaps. "Hello, the cave," I called out. "It's safe to emerge." "But the dragon plant," pleaded Kurok, "is dead and will trouble no one again." I reslung my shield and clipped the razor fern to my waist. There was silence, apart from the rock sizzling like frying meat beneath the sun. Overhead, a rock exploded with a sharp crack, heated by the flood of radiation beyond its capacity to expand. Its fragments clattered on the talus as they surrendered to gravity and fell from the cliff. After a moment, there came the sounds of feet. More than eight, I judged. Sure enough, two individuals emerged, hanging their heads as if shamed by their need for rescue. Kurok was one, and the other I didn't recognize, but they had an immaculate sun coat, and beneath it the smooth, unblemished carapace of one accustomed to sleeping far from the sun. From their disarrayed clothing, they had clearly spent their time in dalliance when they should have been gathering food that would feed their kin through the days when we could no longer emerge from the nest. Kurok turned to look at their companion, then shrugged with a rippling of four shoulders and took a step sideways, distancing themselves from their lover. "Done," they said, and the other hissed in irritation. "You mistake me, Kurok. I spoke to your lover." "No!" I placed a hand on the hilt of my razor fern. "You prefer another price?" Kurok bowed their head and said nothing. "Your price shall be to bear the dragon plant home, to my larder. Hold your tongue, and I may grant you some of the flesh you carry as your reward." I held a hand out to the other one, and they approached and took it cautiously. What is your name, young one?
Thanar.
Thanar, I have a child I would interest you in. They're wiser than this one, I gestured dismissively at the chastened Karak, and I think you'll enjoy their sense of humor. Will you take them into your nest? I removed the flask of sunflower extract from beneath my cloak and held it just out of reach. Their breath hissed between their mandibles, but they didn't hesitate. I'd be honored to share gametes with the child of one as courageous as you. I extended the flask, and they drank deep. Kurok reached for the flask, but withdrew their forearm as I put a hand on the razor fern's hilt. Every move expressing reluctance, they pulled the severed top half of the dragon flower across their back and wiggled until it sat securely between their hindmost six shoulders. Then together, we set off for home across the scorched landscape, darting between clumps of shelter, the sun clawing at our backs. My every joint ached, and I gritted my chelicerae to muster the strength needed to keep ahead of the youngsters. Underfoot, the ground had grown so hot we were forced to hold alternating feet above the ground to prevent them from scorching. The last of the harvesters were gone from sight. I would not breed again, but my line would live on, and Kurok, perhaps their descendants would benefit from their lesson.